In this epidemic, which has the whole country tied up in knots, to almost anybody outside we look weak and vulnerable. Ryan looked up as Andrea came back in. Wait a minute. They made a play for Katie. Why do that if they want me out of the way? What's this? Price asked. The other side has demonstrated a frightening capability. One, Foley said. They got all the way into the Iraqi president's security detail and blew him away. Two, the operation last week was run by a sleeper agent who's been here more than a decade, and in that time did nothing at all. But when he woke up, he cared enough to assist in an attempt on a child. Murray had to agree with that. That's occurred to us, too. The intelligence division is thinking about it right now. Wait a minute, Andrea objected. I know every person on the detail. For God's sake, we lost five of them defending Sandbox. Agent Price, Mary Pat Foley said. You know how many times CIA's been burned by people we knew all about? People I knew. Hell, I lost three agents to one of those fucking moles. I knew them, and I knew the guy who shopped them. Don't tell me about paranoia. We are up against a very capable enemy here, and it only takes one. Murray whistled as the argument took its full form. His mind had been racing for the past few hours in one direction. Now it had to race in another. Mrs. Foley, Andrea, Inspector O'Day said, this isn't personal. Take a step back and think about it. If you had the resources of a nation-state, if you were patient, and if you had people who were really motivated, how would you do it? How did they do Iraq? Ed Foley took up the argument. Would you have thought that was possible? The president looked around the room. Fabulous. Now they're telling me not to trust the Secret Service. It all makes sense if you think like the other guy, Mary Pat told them. It's part of their tradition, remember? Okay, but what do we do about it? Andrea asked, her face openly stunned at the possibility. Pat, you have a new assignment, Murray told his subordinate. With the president's permission, that is. Granted, POTUS breathed. Rules? O'Day wanted to know. None. None at all, Price told him. It was approaching noon over the United Islamic Republic. Maintenance was going well on the six heavy divisions based in the south-central part of the country. Nearly all the tracks on the mechanized fighting vehicles had been replaced. A healthy spirit of competition had developed between the former Iraqi divisions and those moved down from Iran. With their vehicles restored to full fighting order, the troopers drew ammunition to bring all of the T-80 tanks and BMP infantry carriers to full basic loads. The battalion commanders looked over the results of their training exercise with satisfaction. Their newly acquired GPS locators had been like magic, and now the Iraqis understood one of the reasons why the Americans had treated them so harshly in 1991. With GPS, one didn't need roads at all. The Arabic culture had long termed the desert a sea, and now they could navigate on it like sailors, moving from point to point with a confidence they had never known before. Corps and divisional staff officers knew why this was so important. They had just been issued new maps, and with them a new mission. They also learned that their three-corps mechanized force had a name, the Army of God. By tomorrow, subunit commanders would be briefed in on that and many other things. It took an hour for them to get in. Admiral Jackson had been sleeping in his office, but Secretary Brentano had gone home after a marathon session of reviewing deployments within the country. The White House dress code had been relaxed, they saw. The president, also red-eyed, was wearing doctor clothes. Dan Murray and Ed Foley repeated their brief. Jackson took it well. All right, now we know what we're up against. Brentano did not. This is an overt act of war. But we are not the objective, the DCI told him. It's Saudi Arabia and all the other Gulf states. It's the only thing that makes sense. He figures that if he takes over those states, we can't nuke him. It would turn off the oil for the whole world. The DCI almost had it right, but not quite. "And he has India and China in his pocket," Robbie Jackson went on. "They're just running interference, but it's good interference. Ike's in the wrong place. The Indians have their carriers blocking the Straits of Hormuz. We can't get the MPS ships in without air cover. Zap, he moved those three cores down. The Saudis will fight, but they're outmanned. It's over in a week, maybe less." "Not a bad operational concept," the J-3 concluded. "The bio attack's pretty clever, too. I think they got more than they bargained for. Almost every base and unit we have is out of business at the moment," SecDef observed, catching up fast on the operational side. "Mr. President, when I was a boy in Mississippi, I remember the cluckers used to say, 'When you see a mad dog, don't kill the poor thing. Toss it in somebody's backyard.' You know, some sheethead actually did that to us once, 'cause my pap was real big on getting people registered to vote." "What did you do, Rob?" "Pap blew it away with his Fox double," Admiral Jackson replied, "and continued the mission. We have to move fast if we're going to move. Problem is, what with?" "How long before the MPS ships get to Saudi?" "Just under 3 days, but there's somebody in the way. Sinclance cut orders for that surface group to scoot down the Suez, and they can be at the strait in time, but we gotta get those tank carriers past the Indians first. Those four boats are escorted by one cruiser, 2 cans, and 2 frigates. And if we lose them, nearest equipment resupplies in Savannah, sir." "What do we have in storage in Saudi?" Ben Goodley asked. "Enough for a heavy brigade. Same in Kuwait. The 3rd Brigade set is afloat and standing in harm's way." "Kuwait's first in line," the president said. "What can we get there?" "If we're balls to the wall, we can fly the 10th ACR out of Israel to meet up with the Palmkus site south of Kuwait City. That we can do in 24 hours. The Kuwaitis'll handle transport. They have a quiet understanding with Israel on that. We helped broker it," Robbie said. "The plan's called Buffalo Forward." "Anybody think that's a bad idea?" Jack asked. "One armored cavalry regiment. I don't think it's enough to deter them, sir," Goodley said. "The man's right," the J-3 agreed. Ryan looked around the table. Knowing was one thing. Being able to act was something else. He could order a strategic nuclear attack on Iran. He had B-2A stealth bombers at Whiteman Air Force Base. And with the information he'd been given in the past 2 hours, getting sync strike to validate the order under the 2-man rule would not be a problem. The Spirits, as the B-2s were called, could be there in less than 18 hours, and turn that nation into a smoking, poisoned ruin. But he couldn't do that. Even if he had to, he probably couldn't. Though American presidents had long been faced with the necessity of telling the world that, yes, we will launch our missiles and bombers if we have to, it was a duty Ryan never expected to carry out. Even this attack on his country, the use of weapons of mass destruction, to America the equivalent of nuclear arms, had been the decision of one man, and carried out by a relative handful. Could he flatten whole cities in response, kill the innocent as Darii had done, because the other guy had done it first, and live with himself afterward? There had to be something better, some other option. Killing Darii was one. "Ed?"
"Yes, Mr. President?"
"Where are Clark and Chavez right now?"
"Khartoum still, awaiting instructions."
"Think they can get into Tehran again?"
"Won't be easy, sir." He turned to his wife.
"The Russians have helped us in the past. I can ask. What would their mission be?"
"Find out if they can get in first. We'll figure out the mission in a little while."
"Robbie?"
"Yes, Mr. President?"
"The 10th Regiment moves to Kuwait at once." Jackson took a deep and skeptical breath.
"Aye, aye, sir."
There was the intermediary step of getting the approval of the Kuwaiti government. The ambassador handled that. It did not prove to be hard. Major Sabah had kept his government informed of developments in their new neighbor to the north.
and the satellite photos of the retracking of the UIR tanks turned the trick. With their own military fully activated, the Kuwait government telexed a formal request for America to commence an extended training exercise in the western part of their nation. This moved fast. The rulers of the small nation had fresh memories of earlier mistakes. Their only proviso was that the movement be made secretly, and America did not object. Within 4 hours, the plush, brand-new airliners of the National Airline started lifting off, headed southwest over Saudi Arabia, and later turned north, up the Gulf of Aqaba. The order was issued by Training and Doctrine Command, which administratively owned the 10th ACR, since it was technically a training establishment. Most other stateside units belonged to Forces Command, ForceCom. The emergency deployment order went by critic priority to Colonel Sean Magruder. He had roughly 5,000 personnel to move, and that would require 20 jumbo flights. The roundabout routing made for a distance of 1,300 miles and 3 hours in each direction, with an hour's turnaround time at both ends. But it had all been thought through, and the diminution of international air travel had made more aircraft available than the plan had anticipated for Buffalo Forward. Even the Israelis cooperated. The pilots of the Kuwaiti jumbos had the singular experience of seeing F-15 fighters with Blue Star of David markings flying escort as they came into the big Israeli airbase in the Negev. The first group out comprised senior officers and a security group to supplement the Kuwaiti guard force at the Pamukkas site. The site was a group of warehouses containing the complete equipment set of a heavy brigade, which was exactly what the Armored Cavalry Regiment was. The equipment was lovingly maintained by contractors who were well paid by their Kuwaiti hosts. The second aircraft had A Troop, 1st of the 10th. Buses took them through the late afternoon sun to their vehicles, which in every case started up at once, fully loaded with fuel and ammunition. A troop of the 1st Gaidon Squadron rolled out under the watchful eyes of their squadron CO, Lieutenant Colonel Duke Masterman. He had family in the Philadelphia area, and he could add two and two together. Something very bad was happening in his country, and out of a clear sky, Buffalo Forward had been activated. That was fine with him, he decided, and his troopers. Magruder and his staff also watched. He'd even insisted that the command group bring the regimental standard. This was the Cav.
Folieva, is it that bad? Golovko asked, meaning the epidemic.
They were speaking in Russian. Though his English was nearly perfect, the CIA official spoke his native language with a poetic elegance learned from her grandfather.
We don't know, Sergei Nikolaevich, and I have been looking at other things.
Ivan Nemetovich is bearing up.
What do you think? I know you saw the TV interview a few hours ago.
An interesting man, your president. So easy to underestimate. I did that once myself.
And Dariai?
Formidable, but an uncultured barbarian.
Mary Pat could almost hear the man spit.
Quite.
Tell Ivan Nemetovich to think the scenario through, Folieva, Golovko suggested. Yes, we will cooperate, he added, answering a question not yet asked. Fully.
Spasibo. I will be back to you.
Mary Pat looked over at her husband.
You have to love the guy.
I wish he was on our side, the DCI observed.
He is, Ed.
The dog had stopped barking, they noted in Stormtrack. The three corps they were trying to observe had stopped using their radios around noon. Zero. As sophisticated as their computer-aided ELINT equipment was, nothing was still nothing. It was an obvious sign, and just as often overlooked. The direct lines to Washington burned constantly now. More Saudi officers were coming in, demonstrating the increased alert state of their own military, which was quietly deploying to the field around King Khalid Military City. That was some comfort to the intelligence people in the listening post, but not much. They were far closer to the mouth of the lion. Being spooks, they thought like spooks, and by consensus they decided that the events in America had somehow started here. Elsewhere, such thoughts engendered a feeling of helplessness. Here they had a different effect. The rage was real, and they had a mission to fulfill, exposed position or not.
"Okay," Jackson said on the conference line. "Who can we deploy?"
The answer was a brief silence. The army was half the size it had been less than a decade before. There were two heavy divisions in Europe, 5th Corps, but they were quarantined by the Germans. The same was true of the two armored divisions at Fort Hood, Texas, and the 1st Infantry Division mechanized at Fort Riley, Kansas. Parts of the 82nd at Fort Bragg and the 101st at Fort Campbell were deployed to support National Guard units, but the units that had been kept back at their bases had soldiers who'd tested positive for Ebola. The same was true of the two stateside Marine divisions, based at Lejeune in North Carolina and Pendleton in California.
"Look," Forcecom said, "we got the 11th ACR and a guard brigade training up at the NTC. That base is totally clean. We can move them out as quick as you can whistle up the airplanes. The rest? Before we can move them, we have to sort everybody out. I don't dare move them before we've tested every soldier for this damn bug, and the kits ain't out everywhere yet."
"He's right," another voice said. Every head on the conference line nodded. The pharmaceutical companies were racing to produce them. Millions of test kits were needed, but only a few tens of thousands were available, and those were being issued for targeted people, the ones who showed symptoms, relatives or close associates of known cases, truckers delivering food and medical supplies, and, most of all, the medical personnel themselves, who were the most exposed to the virus. Worse still, one clear reading wasn't enough. Some people would have to be tested daily for 3 days or more, because although the test was reliable, the immune systems of potential victims were not. The antibodies could start showing up an hour after a negative test reading. Doctors and hospitals throughout the country were screaming for the kits, and in this case the army was sucking hind tit. "The UIR is going to throw a war," J3 thought, "and nobody's going to come." Robbie wondered if some hippie from the 60s might find that amusing.
"How long on that?"
"End of the week at best," Forcecom replied. "I have an officer on it. I got the 366th Wing at Mountain Home. They're all clean," Air Combat Command reported. "We have the F-16 wing in Israel. My European units are being held hostage, though, all of them."
"Airplanes are nice, Paul," Forcecom said. "So are ships. But we need soldiers over there in one big fucking hurry."
"Cut warning orders to Fort Irwin," Jackson said. "I'll have the SecDef authorize their release within the hour."
"Done."
"Moscow?" Chavez asked. "Jesu Christo, we are getting around."
"Ours is not to reason why."
"Yeah, I know the second part, Mr. C. If we're going to the right place, I'll take that chance."
"Your carriage awaits, gents," Clayton said. "The blue suits are turning the airplane over for you."
"Yeah, that reminds me." Clark pulled the uniform shirt out of the closet. In a minute, he was a colonel again. 5 minutes after that, they were off for the airport, soon to leave the Sudan to the ministrations of Frank Clayton and memories of Chinese Gordon. There was an aspect of schadenfreude about it. O'Day assembled a team of FBI agents to go over the personnel packets of every Secret Service agent who got close to the president, both the plainclothes and uniformed division officers. There were quite a few. Ordinarily, some would have been tossed for obvious no-hit indicators, a name like O'Connor, for example. But this case was too important for that, and every file had to be examined in full before it could be set aside. This job he left to others. Another team was examining something not widely known. There was a computerized record of every telephone call made in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. Legal in a strict sense, the program, had it extended farther afield, would have excited big brotherish outrage from even the most extreme law enforcement hawk,
but the president lived in Washington, and America had lost presidents there. It was almost too much to hope for. By definition, a conspirator in the Secret Service would be an expert on security measures. Their target, if there was one, would be one of the boys. He might stand out in professional excellence. You had to in order to make the detail. But nothing else. He'd fit in. He'd have a good service reputation. He'd tell jokes, bet on ball games, have a beer at the local hangout. He'd be just like all the others who would willingly guard the life of the president as courageously as Don Russell had done, O'Day knew. And part of him hated the rest of him for having to treat them like suspects in a criminal investigation. It wasn't supposed to be this way. But then what was? Diggs called both colonels to his office to give them the news. "We have warning orders to deploy overseas."
"Who?"
Eddington asked. "Both of your units," the general answered.
"Where to, sir?" Ham asked next.
"Saudi. We've both been there and done that before, Al, and here's your chance, Colonel Eddington."
"Why?" the guardsman asked.
"They haven't said yet. I have background information coming into the fax machine now. All they told me over the phone was that the UIR is getting frisky. The 10th is mating up with their Pomkus gear right now."
"Buffalo forward?" Ham asked. "No warning?"
"Correct, Al."
"Is this related to the epidemic?" Eddington asked.
Diggs shook his head.
"Nobody's told me anything about that." It had to be done in federal district court in Baltimore. Edward J. Keelty filed a suit naming John Patrick Ryan as defendant. The substance of the complaint was that the former wanted to cross a state line, and the latter wouldn't let him. The filing asked for summary judgment, the vacating of the executive order of the president. Strangely, the complaint named Ryan as President of the United States immediately. Keelty figured that he'd win this one. The Constitution was on his side, and he'd chosen the judge with care. The Special National Intelligence Estimate was now complete, and irrelevant. The intentions of the United Islamic Republic were totally clear. The trick now was to do something about them, but that was not, strictly speaking, an intelligence function.
Chapter 54. Friends and Neighbors. They didn't see it coming, and it did get their attention. By dawn the next day, all three ground squadrons of the 10th Cavalry were fully deployed, while the 4th Squadron, composed of attack helicopters, needed one more day to get up to speed. Kuwaiti regular officers, their standing army was still relatively small, with the ranks fleshed out by enthusiastic reservists, greeted their American counterparts with waving swords and embraces in front of the cameras, and serious, quiet conversation in the command tents. For his part, Colonel Magruder arranged for one of his squadrons to assemble in parade formation with standards flying. It was good for everyone's morale, and the 52 tanks, massed together, looked like the fist of an angry god. The UIR intelligence service expected something to happen, but not this, and not this fast.
"What is this?"
Dariai demanded, allowing his deadly rage to show for once. Ordinarily it was enough that people knew it was hidden there, somewhere.
"It's a sham."
After the initial shock, his chief of intelligence had taken the time to get a feel for the reality of the situation.
"That is a regiment. Each of the 6 divisions in the Army of God has 3, in 2 cases 4, brigades, and so we are 20 to their 1.
Did you expect that the Americans would not respond at all? That is unrealistic. But here we see they have responded, with 1 regiment moved in from Israel and sent in the wrong place. With this they intend to frighten us?"
"Go on."
The dark eyes softened slightly, merely simmering rather than dangerously hostile.
"America cannot deploy its divisions from Europe. They are contaminated. The same is true of their heavy divisions in America. so we will face the Saudis first of all. It will be a great battle which we shall win. The rump states will surrender to us, or be crushed. And then Kuwait will stand alone, at the top of the Gulf, with its own forces and this American regiment. And then we shall see about that. They probably expect us to invade Kuwait first. We will not repeat that error, will we?
And if they reinforce the Saudis?
Again, they have the equipment for but one brigade in the kingdom. The second is afloat. You talked to India about that, did you not? It was so normal that he might have predicted it, the chief UIR spook thought behind outwardly cowed eyes. They always got nervous just before things started, as though expecting everyone to follow the script they'd written. The enemy was the enemy. He didn't always cooperate. And I doubt they have the troops to move. Aircraft, perhaps, but there is no carrier within 10,000 kilometers, and aircraft, though they are an annoyance, can neither take nor hold ground.
Thank you for making that clear.
The old man's mood softened.
At last we meet, Comrade Colonel, Golovko said to the CIA officer.
Clark had always wondered if he'd see the inside of KGB headquarters. He'd never quite expected to be offered drinks there in the chairman's office. Early in the morning or not, he took a slug of the Starka brand vodka.
Your hospitality is not what I was trained to expect, Comrade Chairman.
We don't do that here any more. Lefortovo prison is more convenient.
He paused, set down his glass, and switched back to tea. A drink with the man was mandatory, but it was early in the day.
I must ask, was it you who brought Madame Gerasimov and the girl out?
Clark nodded. There was nothing to be gained from lying to the man.
Yes, that was me.
You are welcome to all three of them, Ivan. Your father's name?
Timothy. I am Ivan Timofeyevich, Sergei Nikolaevich.
Ah!
Golovko had a good laugh.
As hard as the Cold War was, my friend, it is good now, at the end of it, to see old enemies. 50 years from now, when all of us are dead, historians will compare CIA records with ours, and they will decide who won the intelligence war. Have you any idea what they will decide?
You forget, I was a foot soldier, not a commander, for most of it.
Our Major Cherenko was impressed with you and your young partner here. Your rescue of Koga was impressive. And now we will work together again. Have you been briefed in?
For Chavez, who'd come to manhood watching Rambo movies, and whose early army training had taught him to expect going head-to-head with the Soviets at any time, it was an experience which he wanted to ascribe to jet lag, though both CIA officers had noted how empty the corridors were for their passage. There was no sense letting them see faces they might remember in some other time and some other place.
No, mainly we've been gathering information.
Golovko hit a button on his desk.
Is Bondarenko here?
A few seconds later the door opened, revealing a senior Russian general officer. Both Americans stood. Clark read the medals and gave the man a hard look. Bondarenko did the same. The handshakes exchanged were wary, curious, and strangely warm. They were of an age, raised in one, growing into another.
Gennady Yosefovich is chief of operations. Ivan Timofeyevich is a CIA spy, the chairman explained. As is his quiet young partner. Tell me, Clark, the plague, it comes from Iran?
Yes, that is certain.
Then he is a barbarian, but a clever one. General? Last night you moved your cavalry regiment from Israel to Kuwait, Bondarenko said. They are fine troops, but the correlation of forces is adverse in the extreme. Your country cannot deploy large numbers of troops for at least 2 weeks. He will not give you 2 weeks. We estimate that the heavy division southeast of Baghdad will be ready to move in 3 days, 4 at the most. One day for the approach march to the border area, and then? Then we will see what their plan is.
Any thoughts?
We have no more intelligence on this than you do, Golovko said. Regrettably, most of our assets in the area have been shot, and the generals we befriended in the previous Iraqi regime have left the country.
The high command of the army is Iranian. Many were trained in Britain or America under the Shah as junior officers, and they survived the purges, Bondarenko said.
We have dossiers on many of them, and these are being transmitted to the Pentagon.
That's very cordial of you.
You bet, Ding observed. If they dust us off, next they come north.
Alliances, young man, do not occur for reasons of love, but from mutual interests, Golovko agreed.
If you cannot deal with this maniac today, then we will have to deal with him in 3 years, Bondarenko said seriously. Better today, I think, for all of us.
We have offered our support to Folayeva. She has accepted. When you learn your mission, let us know, and we will see what we can do.
Some would last longer than others. Some would last less. The first recorded death happened in Texas, a golf equipment representative who expired due to heart complications 3 days after being admitted, one day after his wife entered the hospital with her own symptoms. Doctors interviewing her determined that she'd probably contracted the disease by cleaning up after her husband had vomited in the bathroom, not from any intimate contact, because he'd felt too ill even to kiss her after returning from Phoenix. Though seemingly an insignificant conclusion from obvious data, it was faxed to Atlanta, as the CDC had requested all possible information, however minor it might seem. It certainly seemed minor to the medical team in Dallas. The first death for them was both a relief and a horror. A relief because the man's condition toward the end was both hopeless and agonizing. A horror because there would be others just as vile, only longer in coming. The same thing happened 6 hours later in Baltimore. The Winnebago dealer had a pre-existing GI complaint, peptic ulcer disease, which, though controlled by an over-the-counter medication, gave Ebola an easy target. His stomach lining disintegrated, and the patient rapidly bled out while unconscious with his massive dose of painkillers. This, too, came as something of a surprise to the attending physician and nurse. Soon thereafter, more deaths started occurring nationwide. The media reported them, and the country's horror deepened. In the first series of cases, the husband died first, with the wife soon to follow. In many similar cases, children would be next. It was more real for everyone now. For most, the crisis had seemed a distant event. Businesses and schools were closed, and travel was restricted. But the rest of it was a TV event, as things tended to be in Western countries. It was something you saw on a phosphor screen, a moving image augmented by sound, something both real and not. But now the word death was being used with some frequency. Photos of the victims appeared on the screens, in some cases home videos, and the moving pictures of people now dead, their private pasts revealed in moments of pleasure and relaxation, followed by the somber words of reporters who were themselves becoming as familiar as family members. It all entered the public consciousness with an immediacy that was as new and different as it was horrid. It was no longer the sort of nightmare from which one awoke. It was one which went on and on, seeming to grow, like the child's dream in which a black cloud entered a room, growing and growing, approaching despite all attempts at evasion. And you knew that if it touched you, you were lost. Grumbles about the federally imposed travel restrictions died the same day as the golfer in Texas and the recreational vehicle dealer in Maryland. Interpersonal contact, which had first been cut way back, then started to grow again, was restricted to the family member level. People lived on telephones now. Long-distance lines were jammed with calls to ascertain the well-being of relatives and friends, to the point that AT&T, MCI, and the rest ran commercial messages requesting that such calls be kept short, and special access lines were set aside for government and medical use. There was a true national panic now, though it was a quiet, personal one. There were no public demonstrations. Traffic on the streets was virtually nil in the major cities. People even stopped heading for supermarkets, and instead stayed at home, living out of cans or freezers for the time being. Reporters, still moving around with their mobile cameras, reported on all that, and in doing so, they both increased the degree of tension and contributed to its solution. "It's working," General Pickett said over the phone to his former subordinate in Baltimore. "Where are you, John?" Alexander asked. "Dallas. It's working, Colonel. I need you to do something." "What's that?" "Stop playing practitioner. You have residents to do that. I have a working group at Walter Reed. Get the hell over there. You're too big an asset on the theoretical side to waste in a Racal suit doing sticks, Alex." "John, this is my department now, and I have to lead my troops." It was a lesson well remembered from his time in green suits. "Fine, your people know you care, Colonel. Now you can put the damned rifle down and start thinking like a goddamned commander." "This battle's not going to be won in hospitals, is it?" Pickett asked more reasonably. "I have transport waiting for you. There should be a Hummer downstairs to bring you into Reed. Want me to reactivate you and make it an order?" And he could do that, Alexander knew. "Give me half an hour." The associate professor hung up the phone and looked down the corridor. Another body bag was being carried out of a room by some orderlies in plastic suits. There was a pride in being here. Even though he was losing patients and would lose more, he was here being a doctor, doing his best, showing his staff that, yes, he was one of them, ministering to the sick, taking his chances in accordance with the oath he'd sworn at the age of 26. When this was over, the entire team would look back on this with a feeling of solidarity. As horrible as it had been, they'd done the job. "Damn," he swore. John Pickett was right. The battle was being fought here, but it wouldn't be won here. He told his chief assistant that he was heading down to the next floor, which was being run by Dean James. There was an interesting case there. Female, 39, admitted 2 days earlier. Her common-law significant other was dying, and she was distraught, and her blood showed Ebola antibodies, and she'd presented the classic flu symptoms, but the disease hadn't gone further. It had, in fact, seemed to stop. "What gives with this one?" Kathy Ryan was speculating with Dean James. "Don't knock it, Kath," he responded tiredly. "I'm not Dave, but I want to know why. I interviewed her myself. She slept in the same bed with him 2 days before she brought him in." "Did they have sex?" Alex asked, entering the conversation. "No, Alex, they didn't. I asked that. He didn't feel well enough. I think this one's going to survive." And that was a first for Baltimore. "We keep her in for at least a week, Kathy." "I know that, Dave, but this is the first one," Surgeon pointed out. "Something's different here. What is it? We have to know." "Chart?" Kathy handed it over to Alexander. He scanned it. Temperature down to 100.2, blood work, not normal, but... "What does she say, Kathy?" Alexander asked, flipping back through some pages. "How she says she feels, you mean? Panicked. Frightened to death. Massive headaches, abdominal cramps. I think a lot of that is pure stress. Can't blame her, can we?" "These values are all improving. Liver function blipped hard, but that stopped last night, and it's coming back." "That's what got my attention. She's fighting it off, Alex," Dr. Ryan said. "First one. I think we're going to win with her. But why? What's different? What can we learn from this? What can we apply to other patients? That turned the trick for Dr. Alexander. John Pickett was right. He had to get to Reed. Dave, they want me in Washington right now.
Go, the dean replied at once. We're covered here. If you can help make sense of this, get yourself down there.
Kathy, the most likely answer to your question is the simple one. Your ability to fight this thing off is inversely proportional to the number of particles that get into your system. Everybody thinks that just one strand can kill you. That's not true. Nothing's that dangerous. Ebola kills, first of all, by overpowering the immune system. Then it goes to work on the organs. If she only got a small number of the little bastards, then her immune system fought the battle and won. Talk to her some more, Kathy. Every detail of her contact with her husband, whatever, in the last week. I'll call you in a couple of hours. How are you guys doing?
Alex, if there's some hope in this, Dr. James replied, then I think we can hack it.
Alexander went back upstairs for decontamination. First, his suit was thoroughly sprayed. Then he disrobed and changed into greens and a mask, took the clean elevator down to the lobby and out the door.
You Colonel Alexander, a sergeant asked.
Yes.
The NCO saluted. Follow me, sir. We got a Hummer and a driver for you. You want a jacket, sir? Kind of cool out.
Thanks.
He donned the rubberized chemical warfare parka. They were so miserable to wear that it would surely keep him warm all the way down. A female Spec 4 was at the wheel. Alexander got into the uncomfortable seat, buckled the belt, and turned to her.
Go!
Only then did he rethink what he'd told Ryan and James upstairs. His head shook as though to repel an insect. Pickett was right. Maybe.
Mr. President, please, let us re-examine the data first. I even called Dr. Alexander down from Hopkins to work with the group I set up at Reed. It's much too soon for any conclusions. Please, let us do our work.
Okay, General, Ryan said angrily. I'll be here.
Damn, he swore after hanging up.
We have other things to do, sir, Goodley pointed out.
Yeah.
It was still dark when it started in the Pacific time zone. At least getting the aircraft was easy. Jumbos from most of the major airlines were heading for Barstow, California. Their flight crews screened for Ebola antibodies and passed by Army doctors with test kits, which were just now coming online. There were also modifications to the aircraft ventilation systems. At the National Training Center, soldiers were boarding buses. That was normal for the Blue Force, but not for the Op Four, whose families watched the uniformed soldiers leave their homes for the deployment. Little was known except that they were leaving. The destination was a secret for now. The soldiers would learn it only after lifting off for the 16-hour flights. Over 10,000 men and women meant 40 flights, leaving at a rate of only 4 per hour from the rudimentary facilities in the high desert of California. If asked, the local public affairs officers would tell whoever called that the units at Fort Irwin were moving out to assist with the national quarantine. In Washington, a few reporters learned something else.
Thomas Donner, the woman in the mask asked.
That's right, the reporter answered crossly, pulled away from his breakfast table, dressed in jeans and a flannel shirt.
FBI, would you come with me, sir? We have to talk to you about some things.
Am I under arrest? The TV personality demanded.
Only if you want to be, Mr. Donner, the agent told him. But I need you to come with me right now. You won't need anything special, except your wallet and ID and stuff, she added, handing over a surgical mask in a plastic container.
Fine, give me a minute.
The door closed, allowing Donner to kiss his wife, get a jacket, and change shoes. He emerged, put the mask on, and followed the agent to her car.
So what is this all about?
I'm just the limo service, she said, ending the morning's conversation. If he was too dumb to remember that he was a member of the press pool preselected for Pentagon operations, it wasn't her lookout.
The biggest mistake the Iraqis made in 1990 was logistics, Admiral Jackson explained, moving his pointer on the map.
Everybody thinks it's about guns and bombs. It isn't. It's about fuel and information. If you have enough fuel to keep moving, and you know what the other guy's doing, chances are you'll win. The slide changed on the screen next to the map. The pointer moved there next. Here. The satellite photos were clear. Every tank and BMP logger was accompanied by something else. A large collection of fuel bowsers. Artillery limbers were attached to their trucks. Blow-ups showed fuel drums attached to the rear decks of the T-80 tanks. Each contained 55 gallons of diesel. These greatly increased the tank's vulnerability to damage, but could be dropped off by flipping a switch inside the turret.
No doubt about it. They're getting ready to move, probably within the week. We have the 10th Cavalry in place in Kuwait. We have the 11th and the 1st Brigade of the North Carolina National Guard moving now. That's all we can do for the moment. It won't be till Friday at the earliest that we can cut any more units loose from the quarantine.
And that's public information, Ed Foley added.
Essentially, we're deploying one division, a very heavy one, but only one, Jackson concluded. The Kuwait military is fully in the field. The Saudis are spinning up, too.
And the 3rd Brigade depends on getting the MPS ships past the Indian Navy, Secretary Britano pointed out.
We can't do that, Admiral DeMarco informed them. We don't have the combat power to fight our way through.
Jackson didn't reply to that. He couldn't. The acting chief of naval operations was his senior, despite what he thought of him.
"Look, Brucey," Mickey Moore said, turning to look right at him, "my boys need those vehicles, or the Carolina Guard is going to be facing an advancing enemy mechanized force with sidearms. You blue suits been telling us for years how ballsy those Aegis cruisers are. Put up or shut up, okay? By this time tomorrow, I'll have 15,000 soldiers at risk."
"Admiral Jackson," the President said, "your operations."
"Mr. President, without air cover, can we do it or can't we?" Ryan demanded.
"No," DeMarco replied. "I won't see ships wasted that way, not without air cover."
"Robbie, I want your best judgment on this," Secretary Britano said.
"Okay."
Jackson took a breath. "They have a total of about 40 Harriers. Nice airplanes, but not really high performance. The escorting force has a total of maybe 30 surface-to-surface missiles. We don't have to worry about a gunfight. Anzio currently carries 75 SAMs, 15 Tomahawks, and 8 Harpoons.
Kidd has 70 SAMs and 8 Harpoons. O'Bannon isn't a SAM ship. She just has point defense weapons, but she has Harpoons, too. The two frigates that just joined up have about 20 SAMs each. Theoretically, they can fight through."
"It's too dangerous, Jackson. You don't send a surface force against a carrier group by itself, ever."
"What if we shoot first?" Ryan asked. That caused heads to turn.
"Mr. President," it was DeMarco again, "we don't do that. We're not even sure that they are hostile."
"The ambassador thinks they are," Britano told them.
"Admiral DeMarco, that equipment has to be delivered," the President said, his own face coloring up.
"The Air Force is deploying to Saudi now. 2 extra days and we can deal with it, but until then..."
"Admiral, call your relief."
Secretary Britano looked down at his briefing folder. "Your services are not needed here anymore. We don't have 2 days to bicker."
That was actually a violation of protocol. The Joint Chiefs were presidential appointments, and while they were titularly military advisers to the Secretary of Defense and the President, supposedly only the latter could ask one to resign. Admiral DeMarco looked to Ryan's place in the center of the conference table.
"Mr. President, I have to give you my best feel for this."
"Admiral, we have 15,000 men standing in harm's way. You can't tell us that the Navy will not support them."
"You are relieved of duty effective now," the President said. "Good day."
The other uniformed chiefs glanced at one another. This hadn't happened before. "How long before contact with the Indians?" Ryan asked, moving on.
"About 24 hours, sir."
Any way we can provide additional support?
There's a submarine there also, loaded with torpedoes and missiles.
She's about 50 miles in advance of Anzio, Jackson said, as a stunned admiral and his aide left the room.
We can speed her up. That risks detection, but the Indians aren't all that swift on ASW. She would be an offensive weapon, sir. Submarines can't defend passively. They sink ships.
I think the Indian Prime Minister and I need to have a little chat, POTUS observed.
After we get through them, then what?
Well, then we have to transit the strait and make it up to the unloading ports.
That I can help you with, the Air Force Chief of Staff promised. We'll have the F-16s in country and in range for that part of the passage. The 366th Wing won't be ready yet, but the boys from Israel will be.
We're going to need that cover, General, Jackson emphasized.
Well, goddamn, the Navy's asking for help from us air scouts, the Air Force said lightly, then turned serious.
We'll kill every raghead son of a bitch who gets in the air, Robbie. Those 4816 Charlies are locked and cocked. As soon as you're within 100 miles of the strait, you have a friend overhead.
Is it enough? The President asked.
Strictly speaking, no. The other side has 400 top-of-the-line airplanes. When the 366th gets fully set up, in 3 days minimum, we'll have 80 fighters for air-to-air, but the Saudis aren't bad. We have AWACS in place. Your tanks will fight under a neutral sky at worst, Mickey.
The General checked his watch.
They should be getting off right about now.
The first flight of 4 F-15C fighter interceptors rotated aloft together. 20 minutes later, they formed up with their KC-135R tankers. There were 6 of them from their own wing, and others would join from the Montana and North and South Dakota Air National Guard, their home states as yet untouched by the epidemic. For most of the way to the Arabian Peninsula, they'd hold position 10 miles from the lead commercial aircraft coming out of California. The flight path took them north to the pole, then over the hump and south toward Russia, continuing over eastern Europe. West of Cyprus, they would be joined by an Israeli escort, which would convey them as far as Jordan. From there on, the American Eagle fighters would be augmented by Saudi F-15s. They might make the first few arrivals covertly, the planning officers thought in their own commercial transports. But if the other side woke up, then there would be an air battle. The pilots in the lead Eagle flight really didn't mind that very much. There was no extraneous chatter on the radios as they saw dawn to their right. It would be a flight of 2 dawns. The next one would be to their left.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, the public affairs officer told the 15 assembled journalists. Here's the scoop. You have been called up for a military deployment. Sergeant Astor is now handing out consent forms. You will please sign them and hand them back.
What's this? One of them asked.
You maybe want to try reading it, the Marine colonel suggested from behind his mask.
Blood test, one muttered.
I guess so. But what about the rest?
Ma'am, those of you who sign the form will find out more. Those who do not will be driven home.
Curiosity won in every case. They all signed.
Thank you.
The colonel examined all the forms. Now, if you will go through the door to your left, some Navy corpsmen are waiting for you.
He was pleading his own case. Though a member of the bar for 30 years, Ed Keelty had been in a court of law only as a spectator, though on many occasions he'd stood on the steps of a courthouse to make a speech or announcement. It was always dramatic, and so was this.
"May it please the court," the former vice president began. I stand here to request summary judgment. My right to cross a state line has been violated by the executive order of the President. This is contrary to explicit constitutional guarantees and also to Supreme Court precedent, to wit, the Lemuel Penn case, in which the court ruled unanimously. Pat Martin sat beside the Solicitor General, who would speak for the government.
There was a camera from Court TV to send the case up and down via satellite into homes across the nation. It was a strange scene. The judge, the court reporter, the bailiff, all the attorneys, the 10 reporters, and 4 spectators were all wearing surgical masks and rubber gloves. All had just seen Ed Keelty make the greatest political miscalculation of his career, though none had grasped it yet. Martin had come in anticipation of that very fact. Freedom of travel is central to all of the freedoms established and protected by the Constitution. The President has neither constitutional nor statutory authority to deny this freedom to the citizens, most particularly not by the application of armed force, which has already resulted in the death of a citizen and the wounding of several others. "This is a simple point of law," Keelty was saying, half an hour later. "And on behalf of myself and our fellow citizens, I beg the court to set this illegal order aside." With that, Edward J. Keelty took his place. "Your Honor," the Solicitor General said, walking to the podium with the TV microphone, "as the complainant tells us, this is a most important case, but not one of great legal complexity at its foundation." The government cites Mr. Justice Holmes in the celebrated free speech case, where he told us that the suspension of freedoms is permissible when the danger to the country as a whole is both real and present. "The Constitution, Your Honor, is not a suicide pact. The crisis which the country faces today is deadly, as press reports have told us, and it is of a nature that the drafters could not have anticipated. In the late 18th century, I remind learned counsel, the nature of infectious disease was not yet known. But quarantining of ships at the time was both common and accepted. We have Jefferson's embargo of foreign trade as a precedent. But most of all, Your Honor, we have common sense. We cannot sacrifice our citizens on the altar of legal theory." Martin listened, rubbing his nose under the mask. It smelled as though a barrel of Lysol had been spilled in the room. It might have been comical, but was not, when each of the 15 reporters reacted the same way to the blood test. A blink, a sigh of relief. Each one stood and walked to the far side of the room, taking the opportunity to remove his or her mask. When the tests were complete, they were led into another briefing room. "Okay, we have a bus outside to take you to Andrews. You will receive further information after you take off," the PAO colonel told them. "Wait a minute," Tom Donner objected. "Sir, that was on your consent form, remember?" "You were right, John," Alexander said. Epidemiology was the medical profession's version of accounting, and as that dull profession was vital to running a business, so the study of diseases and how they spread was actually the mother of modern medicine, when in the 1830s a French physician had determined that people who became ill died or recovered at the same rate whether they were treated or not. That awkward discovery had forced the medical community to study itself, to look for things that worked and things that did not, and along the way changed medicine from a trade into a scientific art. The devil was always in the details. In this case, it might not be a devil at all, Alex realized. There were now 3,451 Ebola cases in the country. That included those who had started dying, those who showed frank symptoms, and those who showed antibodies. The number by itself wasn't large. Lower than AIDS deaths, lower by more than 2 orders of magnitude than cancer and heart disease. The statistical study, aided by FBI interviews and feedback from local physicians all over the country, had established 223 primary cases, all of them infected at trade shows, and all of whom had infected others who had in turn infected more. Though the incoming cases were still on the upslope, the rate was lower than that predicted by pre-existing computer models. And at Hopkins, they'd had the first case of someone who showed antibodies but no symptoms. There should have been more primary cases, Alex, Pickett said. We started seeing that last night. The first one who died, he flew from Phoenix to Dallas. The FBI got the flight records, and University of Texas tested every